WNYC is a vital part of the New York cultural community. Join us in supporting local organizations, including Ripe Time, an ensemble theater, performing original works and adaptations of novels and stories, Hunterdon Art Museum, exhibiting contemporary art, and offering workshops and courses for adults and children, and New York Composers Circle, providing a forum for composers and performers of new chamber music. For more information about the WNYC Salute the Arts program and its participants, click on events at WNYC.org.
At the turn of the 19th century, Booker T. Washington was the country's most prominent black leader, but since then, his role as a peacekeeper between blacks and whites has earned him a lot of criticism. Robert J. Norell, a professor of history at the University of Tennessee, has re-examined the legacy of Booker T. Washington in his new book, Up From History. It is published by Belknap Press of Harvard Press, and I'm pleased that it brings Professor Norell to the show today. Hello.
Hello there. Thank you for having me.
So in the late 1800s, Booker T. Washington was, in your words, the most famous and most powerful black man in America. What had he done to become such a notable figure?
Well, he had established a college in Alabama, Tuskegee Institute, which grew rapidly thanks to Washington's enterprise and energy. And in 1895, as a result of his building success in Alabama, he was asked to give a speech at the Cotton States Exposition just after Frederick Douglass, who was the recognized black leader of African Americans from the Civil War forward, had died. Washington gave a speech that got a great deal of attention in the way that he offered a kind of settlement of race relations to try to create peace between blacks and whites in the South, especially at a time of intense white racial hysteria, lynching, and growing discrimination.
This is Reconstruction was being deconstructed?
Yes, Reconstruction had ended for some time. Whites had gained total control of the South again and had instituted the oppressive system of segregation.
And who was in his audience?
In his audience in Atlanta were leading white men of the South, industrialists, and a number, of course, of African Americans who were interested in what he would say. Was a moment, really, of great recognition for a black person to be asked to give that talk. And Washington was so persuasive, both to blacks and whites, that he rose instantly to national celebrity.
But he didn't address the fact that black people were losing the right to vote.
Well, he said he did. He said that that black people deserve the right to vote, but that in black people needed to be focused mainly on getting an education and achieving some economic independence, and through material progress, they would rise in America and regain their political rights fully.
Pulling oneself up by one's bootstraps.
Yes.
So he had this recognition and was considered, was respected, and his reputation has declined considerably since.
Yes, Washington was, throughout his life, he died in 1915, recognized among African American, vast majority of African Americans, as a great leader, and among some white Americans, especially Northerners who maintained some interest in the fate of black people in the South. But after he died, especially if we move forward into the 1960s, Washington's reputation declined greatly as he was cast as the kind of opposite pole from the great protest leaders who had emerged in the 1960s, especially, of course, Martin Luther King, Jr.
But he was already being criticized before. W.E.B. Du Bois was criticizing him at the beginning of the 20th century, wasn't he?
That's right. Du Bois and a few other people, but they were a small minority of African Americans, believed that he should have been more assertive, more conflict-oriented, protest-driven than Washington was willing to be. Washington understood the great jeopardy that being a protest leader at in the South in 1900 or 1905 was, there was constant fear of white terrorism, because white terrorism was a everyday reality in the South at that time.
You use the term presentism to explain why Booker T. Washington has come to be looked upon almost as an Uncle Tom figure these days.
Yes, I think some civil rights activists and some academic historians have looked back on Washington from the 1960s and really since the 60s as well, with the orientation of the 1960s, where we came to believe that really the only path to progress for blacks and other minority groups was to protest, was to challenge authority openly and sometimes belligerently, when in fact, it seems to me the reality about how groups rise in American society is more complex, and that the Washington philosophy of developing human resources through education and economics is a method that works at all times, and that it has been unfair to impose the 1960s values, when in fact protests did work for a short while, onto Washington's life when it didn't work so well.
Well, his name wasn't mentioned by Barack Obama on election night, but Senator McCain's concession speech included a mention of Booker T. Washington. Why do you think that is?
Well, it's an interesting point. McCain's hero, of course, is Theodore Roosevelt, and Washington and Theodore Roosevelt were friendly and political allies. And of course, McCain was aware of that and was aware of the intense hostility that was focused on both Washington and Theodore Roosevelt after Washington had dinner at the White House in 1901. It was a huge national uproar and the cause of great hostility to Washington and Roosevelt in the South. I think with regard...
And that was because Roosevelt's daughter Alice was at the table?
Well, that's because having a black man to dinner was a commonly said in the South as the first step on the road to social equality, and quickly white Southerners connected that to interracial sex, and that Roosevelt's 16-year-old daughter there was conjured up in the minds of a lot of white bigots in the South as
Booker T. Washington was going to throw himself on her across the table.
Well, they imagined that and worse. President Obama, of course, is fully educated about the civil rights movement of the 60s and the protests, and of course as many of us are inspired by it. I think, however, he is also not fully apprised of the significance of Washington to black history and to the great similarities between Obama and Washington.
Did Martin Luther King ever express an opinion?
Well, it's interesting. King, early in his career and in books like Stride Toward Freedom, voiced the great admiration that American blacks felt for the most part to Washington through the 1950s. But later on, Martin Luther King began to reflect some of the growing distaste that activists fixed on Washington ex post facto, because he was he lived in the time of segregation.
Do you think that you would have written this book if you were an African American?
I think there are plenty of African Americans who appreciate who appreciate Booker Washington's methods and philosophy. There are a lot. I think that my being a white Southerner made me particularly sympathetic to all that Washington was up against, because I grew up in a white supremacist society and saw it.
My guest is Robert J. Norell, whose book, Up From History, The Life of Booker T. Washington, is published by Belknap Harvard. The title, of course, derives from Booker T. Washington's famous book, Up From Slavery. And he was born into slavery. Where did he grow up?
He grew up, he was born in Southwest Virginia and lived there until the end of the Civil War, when his family migrated over the mountains into West Virginia. And he grew up, lived in a mining village camp in West Virginia, and then went to Hampton Institute as a teenager.
And How old was he when he was emancipated?
He was nine.
You say that his mother, Jane, was the person most responsible for shaping his character.
That's right. His father was a white man. He would later say that the white man was really unknown to him. I don't really think that's true. I think his family knew who Booker's father was and just chose not to make an issue or a point of it, not to make it public. But Jane, his mother, was a strong, adoring mother who created in Booker a personality of confidence and peace and conciliation, but also of great ambition and especially confidence.
One of his other influences was a white woman named Viola Ruffner. Who was she?
She was a lady who hired him to be his houseboy in West Virginia. She was a New Englander, an English teacher, a severe taskmaster who taught Booker how to work, how to write, how to speak properly, and instilled in him great hope that he could rise in this life, and he did.
And she and Samuel Chapman Armstrong had major impact on his view of race relations in the South.
Samuel Chapman Armstrong was the principal of Hampton Institute, where Booker went when he was 16, and he became a great role model. Armstrong was a Union general in the Civil War who stayed in the South to help the emancipated slaves get education. And Booker saw in Armstrong as sort of the model man, the man who embraced Christian values and the Protestant ethic and American democratic values. And Booker took those as his own and used them to try to teach African Americans how to rise in the post-Civil War world.
Was Hampton Institute like a white college?
No, it was a school exclusively for African Americans. The most of the staff, though, was white.
Mm-hmm. But I mean, was the curriculum similar?
Well, it was in the sense that colleges and schools were at that time moving to a kind of combination of vocational and academic education. Armstrong emphasized that blacks needed an education that they could practically use, and Booker took that forward to Tuskegee.
And he played a role in the creation of Tuskegee Institute. Why even created? Weren't there other schools that were doing this job?
Well, there were not really. There had been no schools for blacks during slavery, and states in the South were largely neglecting black education because control had been returned to the old slave-owning class. And it became the job of northern philanthropist and local southern blacks to build schools. And some people in Tuskegee decided they wanted one. And General Armstrong recommended Washington to go and build one.
And it's still around now as Tuskegee University.
It is, yes.
You write that many people thought that the black race should have one leader at that time. Why only one leader?
I think that has to do probably with the role that Frederick Douglass developed and that in a sense he succeeded at in the way that he treated with Abraham Lincoln and during the Civil War. And afterwards, there was a tendency to look to him. And when he died, there was a tendency then to say, well, who is going to replace him? And that is often, and there, you know, later on in black history, there we see that manifest as well.
Although then we come up with rivalries. We have a Marcus Garvey. We have a W.E.B. Du Bois representing different views.
That's right. And, of course, that makes sense, too. Black people are not monolithic. But then, of course, in the 1960s, you get this great mass leader in Martin Luther King. And again, there is the tendency to expect a single leader.
Why did Du Bois and other African Americans from the North criticize the Tuskegee Institute?
They thought that Tuskegee Institute was calling for a single kind of education, industrial education, that they viewed as kind of manual training, training to be maids and simple, unskilled laborers. In fact, Washington was training people for artisan skills, but most of the people who came out of Tuskegee were teachers, and a lot of them went on to be businessmen. What Washington was really trying to do was to develop a broad black petty bourgeois, you know, a bigger middle class.
You write that events in the fall of 1898 showed Washington that the only role open to him politically was that of the fox. To play the lion was to invite disaster. First of all, what happened in 1898? And did he really believe that it was better to be wily, even underhanded, than to be a bit more forthright?
Well, in the fall of 1898, there was a terrible riot in Wilmington, North Carolina, that grew out of an intense political competition between white Democrats and Republicans, many of most of them black, and there was this culminated in a terrible riot, a pogrom, if you will, in Wilmington, North Carolina. Washington had earlier that fall made a strong statement in a big national meeting about the failings of the South to give blacks their equal rights. Those two things got connected in a sense that Washington spoke out forthrightly, then there was this terrible development of really white terrorism that he was really in a risky situation. And at that point, he began to be more circumspect in how he advanced civil rights, but he never stopped calling for and condemning lynching and calling for political rights and equal rights for education and economic opportunity.
Had he been disenfranchised? Could he vote?
Yes, he could vote, but he lived in a county where there would be in a few years a couple of dozen black voters only.
Although he was dissuaded by a friend to not write a letter to the governor condemning lynching.
Well, he did at that at one point. He in a very volatile situation. He was persuaded not to do that, or prevail upon not to do that. But he often did speak out against lynching, in times where the environment was not quite so volatile.
Do you think that we are going to see a reevaluation, a revisionism, when it comes to Booker T. Washington now?
Well, I think that Washington is getting a second look, and I think that people are beginning to see his some of the values of his approach.
Robert J. Norell is Bernadette Schmidt Professor of History at the University of Tennessee. His book, Up From History, The Life of Booker T. Washington, is published by Belknap Harvard. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.